Our next case this morning is number 054354, McDonald against the Estate of Gaten. Mr. Bailey.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brian Bailey, and I represent James McDonald as trustee of the Walter Middleton & Company Retirement Plan in this Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act case. We're here today based upon Judge Manning's granting of summary judgment for the one of the defendants being Monica Gaten due to what she said, the fact that Mr. McDonald had not placed a lien on the fraudulently transferred property prior to Joseph Gaten's death, essentially making it mandatory that a party place a lien on a piece of property in order to recover anything under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act case. We think first and foremost, Judge Manning misapplied and misinterpreted Illinois law as it applies to the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, the purpose of it is to give a creditor a right to seek and avoid a fraudulent transfer to the extent necessary only to satisfy a creditor's claim. Excuse me. There are numerous ways and methods by which the Fraudulent Transfer Act specifically sets out that a party can go ahead and do that. They can levy execution on the property. They can order a forced sale of the property. They can attach the property. And they can get a judgment for the value of the transferred asset or the amount necessary to satisfy the creditor's claim, whichever is less. Now, the one thing that is most important here that the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act specifically provides is for a money judgment and may be entered against the person to whom the asset was transferred. And this court has specifically, in ruling on Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act cases, found that that is an option under the Fraudulent Transfer Act. Judge Cuddy, he had stated that once a fraudulent nature of a transaction is established, 740 ILCS 160/8, which is part of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, provides the creditor with various equitable remedies for the acts of debtors and transferees.
Well, that has to be as a result of the fraudulent transfer, right?
Correct.
And here we have the result of death.
Well, we never even got to the point of whether this was a fraudulent transfer. Judge Manning never ruled on that, whether that's the case or not.
Well, he's already dead, and there was nothing filed.
No, there was. There was no lien filed.
Right.
But we don't believe that. We don't see anywhere in the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act where a lien is a requirement in order to get it. There is no case that I have seen that specifically states looking at the DeMartini case and some of the other cases, that I have to, under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, that I must place a lien on that property before I can recover any relief under the Act.
Well, what if you get a title search? It won't show up, will it?
It won't show up, no.
Well, and how some buyer, somebody's supposed to know whether it's there or not. I'm just looking at it not much in this case, but any case.
Well, here's
why wouldn't it have to be recorded or somehow otherwise to notify the public?
The problem, and this is the whole essence of this case, the problem is once a party fraudulently transfers a piece of property, they no longer, for purposes of the law, they don't own that property anymore. I can't, even if I get a judgment, I can't place a lien on that property right then and there until I bring a fraudulent transfer a case to have that property put back or at least that portion that was transferred make it necessary or out there for me to try to recover against it. And that's, counsel cited recently the Covanda case, and Mr. Covanda tried to intervene in this case, and the problem was he did put a lien on it, and the issue was the lien was no good because Mr. Gaten had already fraudulently transferred all of his interest in the property. So it was a lien on a piece of property that, at least according to law at that time, was in Mrs. Gaten's name. So
this is why he was still alive.
Well, they didn't do it while he was still alive. Because what happened was all the judgments in both those cases came roughly a few weeks before he passed away. But we don't see anything in the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act that says that I have to have a lien on that property in order for me to get a money judgment against Mrs. Gaten. It specifically states that I am entitled, or my client is entitled, to a money judgment against the first transferee for the amount of interest that was transferred.
What if the good faith purchaser buys the property and there's no disclosed lien on it?
I still am entitled to I believe under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, I am still entitled to a to a money judgment or whatever
against,
the portion.
Against a good faith purchaser.
That's what the, if you read, the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act does not distinguish between whether it was a good faith or bad faith purchaser as to the first transferee. As to later transferees, I think it does address that. But as to the first transferee, it does not. It basically says that you were entitled to that judgment against them because that property was fraudulently transferred.
Well, the transferee was not in on the fraud, though.
All I can do is tell you what the Act itself says.
I'm just using a hypothetical.
I understand that. I would still think that if the property was fraudulently transferred, it should have belonged to that person, and they may have a cause of action against the party that fraudulently transferred it to them, but I think that my client, or in this case the debtor, should not be barred from going after that piece of property. Essentially, what you would be doing is, and what this case does, is it provides a blueprint, especially for someone who is terminally ill or someone who is contemplating suicide because they're so far in debt, as to how to defraud creditors. Because what it is if somebody comes in and says, I'm about to pass away, or I've been told I'm going to pass away, I'm going to transfer all my interest to a third party, and I'm going to do it fraudulently. Then, by the time someone can get a money judgment against me, at that point, they still can't put a lien on my property because I technically don't own the property at that point until somebody brings a fraudulent transfer act case. Once that happens, that's going to be another...
Could you casually address the issues that were raised in the state appellate court proceeding?
Sure. In that case, I think that Mr. Cavanda went a little too far and that court relied upon as the basis for finding that there was in a case such as this, that the right of survivorship is reinstated, relies upon this very case, which is on appeal. Excuse me. In that case, Mr. Cavanda did put a lien on the property, and the issue was whether, and Mrs. Gayton ended up suing him to try to quiet the title of the property.
She dropped that portion of the suit, but proceeded on whether or not there was a lien.
Correct. And in that case, the court relied upon two cases to substantiate his ruling. Number one is the Gilbert case, and number two is this very case. We respectfully request and that your honors take into account that the one case that they rely upon for survivorship is this very case. The court didn't even acknowledge in that, the first district not even acknowledge that this case is on appeal. They just basically said this is the law. In terms of the Gilbert case...
You were talking about Illinois law, and this, I assume, is some definitive discussion of Illinois law.
Well, but they're relying upon Judge Manning's ruling, which if this court decides that Judge Manning was incorrect in her interpretation...
They're deciding a case of Illinois law. What they rely on is not material to any issue I can think of. But they're defining what the Illinois law is, and you said the Illinois law is something... which would be contrary to the findings in this case.
Right. Well, if you look at that decision, there is no analysis whatsoever for that statement. It's just a blanket statement, and it cites this case.
It's a rather lengthy discussion of the law involved and how it worked and so on.
But the portion that governs or would have anything to do with this case roughly is about a paragraph or two. Mm. The majority of the decision, I don't think, does address the issues that are involved in this case, which are essentially what happens to that property if we win the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act claim. And does that property, the DeMartini case specifically said that the property does not go back, either equitable or legal interest isn't transferred back to the debtor, that and as between the transferees, the two transferee and transfer, the property, the conveyance stays the same. Thus, what they want in this case is to say, if you're relying on a DeMartini, you would have to say, number one, we still have a valid transfer as to the whole world other than my client of the property by quitclaim deed from Mr. Gayton to Mrs. Gayton. However, also, somewhere down the line, you're throwing the fact that not only is it valid as to the whole world, but now we're going to allow him, just for purposes of my client, to claim that there's also a joint tenancy here. So you can't have it both ways. Either the transfer is valid, which is what DeMartini says, you have a valid transfer, or you have a joint tenancy. But there's no the Gilbert case specifically is distinguishable. Gilbert in dicta basically makes the comment that, well, we don't think anyways they would have recovered because...
You're not going to have any time left at all for us.
I'm sorry. I will respectfully ask the court to reverse the decision and grant me a few minutes to...
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. We'll hear now from Mr. McEntee.
it please the court, my name is Barry McEntee on behalf of the defendant, Monica Gaten, in this case. We submit that summary judgment was proper and that this court should affirm. Judge, the principal issue in this case is relatively straightforward. It is whether avoidance of fraudulently transferred property can place a creditor, like Mr. McDonald, in a superior position in relation to reaching that property than Mr. McDonald would have been had the transfer never occurred. The district court properly answered this question by saying, no, that is not allowed, and concluded that when a fraudulent transfer of joint tenancy property is set aside, the creditor, Mr. McDonald in this case, is put back in the identical position that he occupied prior to the transfer. This morning, I'd just like briefly to discuss the public policy reasons that support affirming the district court's order. The first has to do with the public policy purposes and structure of UFTA. UFTA exists to serve a very important purpose, to prevent debtors from taking property and putting it beyond the reach of creditors through a fraudulent transfer. UFTA creates a mechanism which basically states that, look, if the fraudulent transfer is what puts the property outside of the reach of the creditor, we're going to intervene and we're going to set that aside. Mr. McDonald, in this case, is trying to have UFTA serve an interest and carry out a purpose that it was not created to do, which is to say, if some other impediment or cause is what puts the property outside of your reach, then UFTA is no remedy. Here in this case, the untimely death of Mr. Gaten on November 26, 2003 is what forever closed the door to Mr. McDonald ever satisfying his judgment against Mr. McDonald with the Wilmette property.
Could I ask just preliminary, what was the purpose of this loan? It's what, $350,000 or something?
Judge, there were a number of notes which total in or around $350,000, and I believe the record reflects that they were business loans.
All unsecured, apparently.
As I understand that, although I'll leave that to Mr. Bailey to address in his remarks, because I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay, and but there's obviously no mortgage or anything on the house.
The record does not reflect any mortgage on the Wilmette home.
So a title search wouldn't show anything.
That's correct, Judge. Homes. Okay. The second major public policy concern that is afoot here is the risk of inconsistent decisions. The fact that the Illinois Appellate Court has addressed this very transfer, this very property, this very legal theory, and concluded that creditors in this instance cannot state a claim for relief under UFTA urges this court to affirm the district court's order. Reversing would create a situation where the first district, which is the intermediate court in Illinois, applying Illinois law, reaches one decision, and the Seventh Circuit, applying Illinois law, reaches another. The only precedents on point are Gilbert and Kavanda, and they mandate affirmance. If the court doesn't have any questions of me for these reasons and the reasons stated in my brief, we ask that this court affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Mrs. Gaten. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bailey, you have a minute left.
I'll quickly address a couple of the issues. The first being the public policy of inconsistent decisions. I guess the theory is if there's a wrong decision out there, we just let it be because it's the wrong decision and we shouldn't change that. If the court was wrong, the court was wrong. The Kavanda case, again, relies upon two cases. This case being the McDonald case, and the Gilbert case. The Gilbert case is clearly distinguishable because the Gilbert case talks about the fact that there was no judgment rendered prior to the death of the decedent. In this case, there was a non-pro-tunk order which was entered by Judge Norgel to a date prior to Mr. Gaten's death.
How do you record that?
You know what? The purpose of the nunk-pro-tunk order is to avoid injustice. And there is no case I have seen one way or the other that talks about what would happen in a case where a fraudulently transferred piece of property, where a judgment is entered. We were, because of the delay by the district court, we were barred from doing anything. We couldn't have recorded it. And we are, you know, it was not our fault. We could have run in and tried to do something if we had gotten that judgment immediately when we should have gotten it. So therefore, we were in essence, a judgment is not supposed to be a nullity. And in this case, it was not our fault that judgment was not entered prior to his death. And that's why Judge Norgel did enter it prior to his death. We think that the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, there is no requirement that a lien must be placed on a piece of property before you can, in order to require or to recover anything under that act. We don't see such a requirement in there. And we would therefore ask this court to reverse Judge Manning's decision and remand this case to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement. The sixth case originally scheduled for this morning, number 06-1007, the United States against Kuzlink. Oral argument has been postponed in that case. The court has finished the call of the morning, and therefore we will rise until 9:30 tomorrow.